This episode is brought to you by DMV Black Restaurant Week, bringing culture, education, and good food to eaters in the D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area.
You're listening to Item 13, an African food podcast, and I'm your host, Yom Akuaku. Every week, we'll delve into the delicious world of African food, including chefs, curators, and bloggers. Here's the show.
Welcome to the show, Dominique. I am excited to have you on. We're going to be talking Liberian food. We're going to be talking about your background a little bit, the work you're doing with spices and your catering company. And also, I think I want to touch on, we didn't talk about that earlier, but I want to touch on how you're doing with everything that's going on with COVID and all of that. One, personally, and then also just in terms of the business. So a lot to talk about in 45 minutes or so, but let's get into it. So I'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you? Where are you from?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be on the show and to talk a little bit about myself and my background. So I guess, who am I? I am a first generation American. My family is from Liberia. I was actually born and raised in Maryland, so I grew up here. Spent some time in New York for undergrad, where I studied hotel and tourism management at NYU. Moved out to Vegas, was working there as a restaurant manager for some time, and then relocated back to the East Coast to pursue a path in culinary arts in a more professional sense. And so I started cooking with the Four Seasons, and then I even launched a catering company, Talbert Hospitality. And that's what kind of got me to a lot of the point of where I am in terms of the culinary world and my artistry. And now I'm currently an MBA student at GW, going into my second and my last year. So I've done a little bit of a lot of different things.
Yeah. Cool. Congrats on the MBA too. Like I that seems like a lifetime ago. I finished my MBA like 5 or 6 years ago now, and that was no small feat. So I can't imagine trying to do that now, especially in this environment. So it's interesting to, your story was interesting to me, one, in that a lot of the people that I interview on the podcast who actually cook, don't have professional training, or they sort of stumbled into it. So you did the hospitality thing right away. Do you have any sort of early food memories that made you, or any memories from childhood that you think sort of pushed you in this direction? Like I said, there's a lot of people I speak to that sort of stumble into it. It sounds like you had a clear path to the extent that you even went to school for hospitality.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I grew up with aunts who were very, very great cooks, cooked often for the family and for different events. And I mean, I think one of my most fond food memories was, I used to go to one of my aunt's house a lot growing up, and she is a great cook, and she would, I remember one time we were in her house, like Bob Marley was blasting. She was like frying fish and making pepper sauce or something. And then she had like a rum cake baking. And I think that was just like my favorite food memory ever, because you're bringing together all these different flavors and all these different sounds and smells in the kitchen. And then you have like good music playing, and it's just a whole vibe. It's a whole ambiance. And so when I think of food and kind of what I do with Talbert Hospitality in terms of the pop-up events I host, I try to recreate that same type of experience where people can enjoy a vibe through food, good music, and conversation, that kind of stuff. And then for me growing up, I always used to watch the Food Network. And I used to have my cousins, they would make fun of me and they'd be like, oh, she's always watching the Food Network. Why is she always doing that? But like now they're always asking me to cook for them. So it's just funny. I don't know what really intrigued me about cooking necessarily being so young, but it's something that I've always, just always being in the kitchen, especially the way that I learn is from seeing and doing. I never went to culinary school officially, so the training that I've received was from professional training from the Four Seasons specifically, and then what I've kind of been able to pick up over the years from cooking with different chefs, cooking with home cooks, and just watching TV, watching Netflix, YouTube, and I guess the Food Network. So, yeah.
Yeah, like I'm interested in that too, because you've had extensive experience. I don't know how many years this is, but you've done, you know, you mentioned, you know, you're a restaurant manager in Vegas, and then cooking at the Four Seasons. What was that experience like, working in a professional kitchen at the Four Seasons? Was that your first time, or like how did that even happen?
It's a funny, it's an interesting story, because I actually wanted to go to culinary school instead of going to get a hotel and tourism management degree, but having African parents, you know, they're kind of strict. They're like, culinary is not a real thing. You need to go study business or something else. So hospitality, hotel and tourism management was like a specialized business degree, which is what which was a happy medium between me kind of pursuing my interests, but also getting an actual degree. And so throughout my career in undergrad, I interned in China. I did some like study abroad sessions in Cuba, interned in different places throughout New York City, and just, you know, connecting with different people over the years. And the Four Seasons was a company that I interned with in Shanghai and then also in Baltimore, both in food and beverage outlets. And so when I moved out to Vegas and I was thinking about leaving and relocating and kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do next, but also keeping in mind that I knew I wanted to do something more creative and probably getting into the culinary sense, I had a chef who I met and worked with at the Four Seasons in Baltimore who came out to Vegas literally 2 weeks before I was supposed to leave. And she was like, you know, there's some positions open at the property. It's for a prep cook. So it's like not necessarily the bottom in the kitchen, but one of the most starter positions in the kitchen. And she said, you could learn a lot there. The pay isn't good, but you'll definitely learn. And it's a good way to go get your hands dirty in the kitchen and not necessarily go to culinary school. And so that same night I applied for the position. I got a call the next morning from HR, and the person from HR was actually somebody I knew who worked at the Four Seasons in New York and somebody I had met through at NYU for like recruiting for different things. And so she was already familiar with myself, and they were like, yeah, when you come back to the East Coast, just let us know and we'll schedule an interview for you. And they were really pushing for me to get into management again. And I was very adamant about wanting to do culinary. And they were all like, are you sure? It's a lot of hard work. The pay isn't good. It's a different type of thing. And I'm like, no, I want to do it. And so I just spoke to different property managers, some that I was already familiar with because I had interned there and I had worked with them before. And they were like, all right, so you can start. We know who you are. We know you'll do the work. And so that was kind of it. They took a chance on me, but it's funny how things kind of align based on who I met over the past few years.
Yeah, and when you, I mean, I guess all those people are warning you, but even from like watching, you know, Netflix shows or the Food Network, it sounds like working in a professional, or it looks like working in a professional kitchen can be really tough. And you see chefs like Gordon Ramsay and how they treat people in the kitchen. I don't know if you had that sort of experience going, or even that sense of trepidation, I would say, going in, knowing how people are treated in the kitchen. I guess maybe you're fueled by your own passion or desire to learn how to cook professionally in that way, but I wonder if that sort of crossed your mind as well.
Yeah, I mean, the kitchen is a tough environment. And for me, I started as a prep cook in that kitchen. And so prep is essentially, you know, cutting up vegetables all day, making the stocks and sauces, soups and all of that for the cooks to make, cooks to use for service. And it's like doing the brunt work. So some days I would be shucking oysters for like hours, or chopping up onions, or making all kinds of things. And so that in itself is tough, and it's a lot of labor. Like you're lifting up heavy pots, like 80 quart pots, 100 quart pots. You're taking things up and down stairs, and so that is physically demanding on you. And then once I got onto the line, I'm now, you know, prepping for service, which is a different type of work. It's a more of a mental challenge, because you have to now more so work work with more speed because now you're servicing the customer. You're not necessarily servicing your teammates. And so you're servicing the customer. And then there's also a finesse to it because you want to make sure whatever you're presenting looks good for the customer to eat and also tastes good as well. And so you're working with multiple stations because maybe I'm making a salad on my station, but somebody is making an appetizer on another station, and both of those two items have to go out together. And so it really teaches you about teamwork. It teaches you about organization, preparation, and really it's a mental game. My chefs, fortunately, I wasn't working with chefs who were cursing us out or had like these terrible attitudes. Of course, when it's, you know, busy in the kitchen, it's hot. People are messing up sometimes, you know, tempers can occur, but it was never anything where I would say I was working in a toxic environment, which was fortunate for me. It was definitely high pressure and stress in a sense because, you know, you are working against the clock, but I was lucky enough to have a good leadership team, which I'm grateful for.
That's amazing. You don't hear that too often. And so then how did you, or when and how, I guess, did you decide to transition from, you know, working for other people to doing your own thing? And I know, I think it started with, your hospitality group started with the Sunday dinners, right?
So, I mean, when I was in college, I used to host these things called Sunday dinners, and that was just like very informal, but a kind of way for me to get my friends together and friends of friends together around food. Cause like I used to be the one that cooked all the time. And then eventually we made it into something where we'd say, okay, we're going to invite these people over. I'll do the food. And then everyone can bring the drinks or the dessert or whatever else. And so that's how the Sunday dinner experience started. In terms of when Talbert Hospitality started and me kind of going into entrepreneurship was while I was at the Four Seasons, because literally my salary from being a manager to being a cook was cut in more than half. And so not having extra funds was something that was challenging for me. And then also being on prep, I was like, looking at those cooks coming in to cook for service, and I'm like, okay, I want to do some of that stuff. So how can I be creative on my own? How can I compose dishes for other people and kind of get their feedback on it? And so that's why I thought to launch Talbert Hospitality, to make some extra money and then also to try out some of the creative things that I was seeing being in the kitchen. And so the first event that I did with Talbert Hospitality was actually something called It's a Crab Feast. And so that's a West African inspired crab feast to kind of pay homage to my Liberian roots, but also being from Maryland, where crabs is a big part of things. And then crab feast, because all of the pop-up events are served family style. It really allows people to connect with strangers, argue over the last bite of food, really like get in there and kind of engage. How I was talking about creating this whole experience around food, music, and conversation. And so that's what I launched the company with. And then I would also do like private catering gigs. And then I did a couple Sunday dinner series. I did one in Baltimore, one in Brooklyn. I do something also called Dine and Dish, which is bringing women together specifically around different conversation topics and food. And so I try to do those when I have some time, at least 2 to 4 times a year.
Wow, that's a lot. And that all sounds really good. And well, hopefully post-COVID, I really hope I can get to enjoy some of that for sure. So then, I guess speaking of COVID, I'm sure that has changed, you know, what you're able to do with the hospitality piece, right? Are you doing anything different now? How has that affected your business?
Yeah, COVID affected everything. I mean, even before COVID, me starting my MBA was a big risk in a sense, because I knew that was a huge time commitment. So once I started my MBA, I really wasn't taking clients as often as I was before. Maybe doing things once a month as opposed to 4 times a month or whatever else. And so when COVID happened, it's really, I think I'm one of the people who is more hesitant to really be around others. And I was just like, yeah, I'm not taking on gigs. And everything that I had scheduled from like February to May eventually got canceled. And as the months came on, it was like, okay, this is canceled. This client doesn't want to do this. They're going to reschedule this from the next time. So I haven't done any catering gigs since February, I want to say. But actually this past weekend I did, it's a crab feast, but I offered it as a to-go service. So people could pick up and, kind of recreate their own feast. I included a list of nearby parks from the pickup location, Afrobeats playlist for them to listen to and, you know, had some of the same food that I would have been serving in person, but just allowing them to recreate their own. And so that was something, that kind of service was something that I had never done before. And it presented its own challenges in a sense, but definitely some lessons learned. And so I think me doing those kind of things will be what will happen in the future, because I'm not comfortable with catering. Like, I don't need to be in other people's homes right now.
Yeah.
I can cook in the private kitchen and then have people pick up or like take it to their car, as I did with It's a Crab Feast. And then the other beautiful thing about COVID, in a sense, is that it's allowed me to slow down and focus on my other company, Mishan Spices. And so that's something that I actually developed from Tober Hospitality, because from that company, I make all the sauces, dressings, marinades, spice blends, everything from scratch. And usually I'll have clients ask me to leave different things for them behind so that they can cook with throughout the week. And so when I started my MBA program and I was attending different entrepreneurial sessions and just, you know, taking more business classes, I was like, how can I look into a product-based business instead of a service-based business and learn how to scale that? And so I tested it out with Mishan Spices, basically launching with 4 different blends, 3 savory and 1 sweet, and then seeing how it would be received by other people outside of my clients. And so I sold like 200 jars of spices in the first month and a half or 2 months. And then I entered into a new venture competition with GW. And then I just finished up a summer startup accelerator with GW's Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And so I have a website for Mishan Spices now. I have the company is incorporated. I filed a trademark for it. And so, you know, that's something that I can do in the midst of COVID to still kind of share this African diaspora flavors and food experience, but allowing people to do it in their own homes instead of me kind of coming to them.
That's amazing. I was going to ask you about the spice line, but you've said everything there is to say about it, I guess. I think one of the questions though that I wanted to ask was the origin of the name Mishan.
Mishan is actually, it means food in Pele. So in Liberia, there's 16 different tribes and each one speaks their own dialect. And so my father, he's Pele. And so just kind of, you know, paying homage to my roots again, trying to do something different. And, you know, with the spices being inspired by the African diaspora, I said, what can I kind of bring in there? And so I like how it sounds. I don't speak any Pele other than knowing how to say that. So that's what I went with. So it translates to food, spices, in a sense, but Mishan is, that's the origin of the name.
Yeah, and then do you mind speaking about, because you have 4 spice blends, right? Do you mind speaking about each of the 4 really briefly? Because there's one that's called Better Than, and I like wanted to understand why you call that Better Than. And then the coffee cumin, I'm also pretty curious about, because I like coffee in general. And then I also like coffee like in food, too. So I thought that was pretty.
Yeah. So Better Than, being from Maryland, Old Bay is huge. And so when I started the Crab Feast, I wanted to create my own spice blend for crabs instead of using Old Bay. And so Better Than, it used to be called Better Than Old Bay, but I didn't want to get sued by anybody. And so I just shortened it to Better Than. And then so it is a West African version of, you know, a seafood spice. And so it has some smokiness to it. It has some like cayenne and habanero peppers in it. So you get a little bit of spice. It's not as salty, but it gives some well-rounded flavors. And so it's called Better Than because I think it's better than, you know, all the other stuff that's out there. And I know a lot of people use it. It's basically a good all-purpose seasoning. So you can use it on French fries. You can use it on fried chicken. You can put it, I know people who cook Liberian food with it. All sorts of things. And then coffee cumin was something I actually developed for clients who liked lamb a lot. And so not only, you know, thinking of what I can do, something different. Coffee is very prevalent in different West African countries in terms of what we grow there and distribute and harvest. And then thinking like what goes well with lamb. So the coffee and cumin mixture gives a really nice smoky and depth of body flavor to lamb chops. But also it's good for different stews and things like that. Even if you can't grill, it does give a smoky flavor to whatever you use it on, which is really nice.
Cool. And where can you describe it all so deliciously? Where can people find it if they want to buy it right now?
Yeah, so I have a website. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, but the website is called MeshanSpices.com. So MESEAN spices.com. And so I have two other blends. There's the Peruvian garlic, which is heavy in garlic and is kind of paying homage to the Latin American side of the African diaspora. It's good for roasted poultry and greens. And then something sweet is something that I developed based on what I mix into cocktails. So anytime I make cocktail mixers for pop-up events or for clients, I do a mixture of sugars and spices. And so that's what that blend has in there. So you can make cocktails, you can make like French toast and pancake batter. I know people make like savory foods with it as well. So you can do all kind of stuff with that spice.
All right, I think this is a good time to take a quick short break. And then when we come back, we'll go into the topic of Liberian cuisine and then talk about what's next for you, like your MBA program. You mentioned a summer accelerator. We can talk about that. And then what's next post-MBA. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by DMV Black Restaurant Week, bringing together Black restaurant owners in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area with a mission to keep Black food culture alive. But DMV Black Restaurant Week is not just about a week. It's about making an impact in the community all year round. By advocating for local Black-owned restaurants, DMV Black Restaurant Week aims to use food as a force for good. In 2020, they're planning signature programming like the Business of Food and Education Conference, cocktail competition, and more. Learn more about how DMV Black Restaurant Week is promoting culture, education, and good food at dmvbrw.com.
So we're back, and it's time to talk more food, Liberian food specifically. I personally don't have that much experience with Liberian. The only Liberian food I've had is Liberian jollof. And I don't, like, jollof is a very, and this is a very personal and can also be a touchy subject. So, like, that's all I will say about Liberian food I've tried. I'll have you explain to people, like, maybe the staple foods or the things you should try if you go to a place that has Liberian food or you ever visit Liberia.
Yeah, I mean, so jollof, yeah. Liberians make good jollof rice. I believe so.
Okay, no comment.
I think the only people who can touch our jollof are Senegalese people. So I'll just put that on the record for those who might be curious.
Like I said, no comment. I've had Liberian, I've had Senegalese, I've had Ghanaian, I've had Nigerian. I've had Sierra Leoneans also do a jollof. I had Sierra Leonean. So yeah. I don't want to start any West African wars right here. So we'll leave it at that.
I think if people might have had Sierra Leonean or Guinean food, but not Liberian food, those cuisines are similar in a sense to Liberian because we border and we share a lot of cuisines. I will say those two places, though, they cook with a lot more okra in some of the foods and then also more ground pea or ground peanut, whereas we don't do some of that, the combinations that they do. But it is similar in a sense. But Liberian food is it's heavy plant-based. Of course, we add a lot of meats to it. And depending on what region you're from of Liberia, you'll cook with more seafood or more dry meats or goat meat and stuff like that. Some of my favorite Liberian dishes, I love okra sauce. So it's okra. I like okra sauce. They usually put a lot of seafood on okra sauce. Okra sauce and tabagi are two of my favorite Liberian dishes. So there's a lot of seafood in them. It's cooked with red palm oil. The okra does have, we cook it so that it has like a little bit of a slimy texture, and you can eat that with rice or fufu. The tabagi, it's made either with, it can be made with okra or it can be made with beans. I prefer either one. I don't have a preference. We do spinach. We do cassava leaf, which I think a lot of people have heard of. Cassava leaf has a more hearty texture than, you know, potato greens in a sense. We cook collard greens. We cook a lot of plant-based things that has meat in it. So, I mean, if we don't cook with red oil that is just made with regular cooking oil, some things are eaten with fufu, other things are eaten with rice. There's a saying in our culture like, oh, you don't eat red oil on Sundays because it's kind of taboo for whatever reason. So that's something that some people don't do. Because we are on the coast, there's a lot of seafood, a lot of fresh seafood there, which is really good. You can get some good fish. I really like barracuda in Liberia. You can't really get barracuda elsewhere outside of in a lot of different places because it has like, it's said to have a lot of mercury in it, and some different places restrict that. But Liberia has some good seafood. They have huge lobsters. I did a pop-up event there, I think 2 years ago now, and like the lobster head was the size of my hand, which was like biggest lobsters that I've ever seen. So the seafood there is really good and really fresh. We don't eat a lot of dairy in our food. Traditional breakfast will be like cassava, plantains, or yams with, you know, some type of gravy, whether it's smoked fish gravy, which is smoked salted herring, or with corned beef or whatever, fish gravy or whatever else. So I don't know. Does that describe Liberian?
Yeah, that's very eye-opening to me. And I think I read somewhere some time ago that like, because we don't, in West Africa in general, we don't bake a lot of like, and a lot of sweet foods. I mean, bread, outside of bread. But I heard that baking is uniquely Liberian, in the context of West Africa anyway. The Liberians bake a lot. I don't know if that's your experience, but I feel like someone has mentioned that to me.
I mean, I don't think Liberians bake a lot compared to some other cultures, but I couldn't say compared to other West Africans. So we make shortbread, which is basically biscuits in a sense, but it's sweetened biscuits. And so sometimes they also make something called cassava bread, which is like the shredded cassava, and it's really good. Sometimes people mix it with coconut. We make rice bread, which is made from plantains or bananas mixed with cream of rice and some other stuff. And that's gluten-free. We make donuts or kala. I think some people call it puff puff or bofu.
Yeah, bofloats, puff puff that we fry.
Yeah. So we make that, and you can make that just with like plain flour. Some people put plantain in it, and we usually eat it with pepper, like fried pepper sauce. So, I mean, there's not a lot of baking that we do, but maybe it's more than some other people. And then some.
Yeah, maybe when compared to other West African countries, I guess. It sounds a lot more than we do.
Liberians make some good pepper soup too, so I think a lot of West Africans that eat pepper soup, Liberians make that as well.
Oh, do you make it? Is it a tomato-based like pepper soup?
Some people make it differently. So some people put tomatoes in it, some people don't. Some people will make ground pea soup, so they add in a little bit of ground peanut to it. It depends on who you are.
Yeah, because there's a Liberian Liberian Ghanaian actually cook here in the Seattle area, and my husband and I had ordered he wanted Nigerian pepper soup, and so we had ordered pepper soup from her, and what we got looked more like a Ghanaian light, which it was great, it tasted fantastic, but I think in his head he associated like Nigerian pepper soup to be like tomato-less versus like what we call light soup. which it looked like. So that's why I was wondering about that.
Yeah, I think it does look more like light soup because the way we make it, we'll like cut up onions, the pepper. Some people will put ginger in it. And then you add the different smoked meats. So if it's smoked turkey, ham hocks, or whatever else, your smoked fish. And then you like cook that down to make the broth in a sense. And then you'll start adding in your meats. So if it's chicken or goat meat, or if you're just doing all seafood. And then some people will add some tomatoes in it to give it some more flavor. Other people will add the ground pea if you want to make it more peanutty. And then you eat it with fufu, or you eat it with something we call dumboy, which is it's like fermented cassava that's made into fufu. And or you can eat it by itself. It's like personal preference.
That all sounds so good. Like, I guess you grew up eating it at home and then making it, but are there places like in my DC area in New York that you could get Liberian food?
So not in DC, there hasn't been a Liberian restaurant in some time. There's, I think some people like set up like small cook shops every now and then. There was a restaurant in New York that was open for a while outside in Queens, but they closed down maybe 2 years ago.
Oh.
So right now there's not a lot of Liberian restaurants.
Right now it's just you dominating the Northeast essentially.
So no, not necessarily me, because my cuisine focus isn't Liberian strictly. It's more so Liberian fusion. So
fusion, yeah.
I'll mix in the flavors of Latin America and the Caribbean. Every now and then I'll do some like strict or more traditional Liberian foods, but not so much. There's a chef, Chef Dalmas Hare. He has a company called LIB Foods, so you can order. He like mails food out to people, and he does like all the Liberian traditional dishes. It's not a restaurant, but if most people who are looking for Liberian food, and if their family isn't cooking it or they don't feel like cooking it, they'll order from him.
No, that's cool. I will look that up. There's a lot of people that are doing that these days, is mailing food around the country. So with the little time we have, let's see if we can do this. I wanted to touch base now that we've almost run out of time, it's going to be very briefly, because I don't know how many people know sort of the connection of Liberia to like the African American population in the US, especially in the context of everything that's going on. And as you were talking about Liberian food and you mentioned things like collard greens or shortbread, it reminded me again of that connection. And as I think about the current space we are in right now, I don't know if you have any thoughts on especially the interaction between, because you are first gen, so I'll just use that, first gen Africans versus African Americans versus African immigrants in this space where we're trying to uplift all Black people. I bring that up because for those that don't know, Liberia started as a country from freed Black slaves and freeborn Blacks from the U.S. And from what I understand, even in that initial like move to the continent, there was also some initial, and I don't know if that's still the case today, but initial friction between people that moved versus the local or native Liberians at the time. And so it was interesting to me as I thought about interviewing you, that connection. And I don't know if you have any thoughts, and you may not have any thoughts, which is fine, but I just thought that it was an interesting connection.
Yeah, I have some thoughts. It's a very nuanced argument, if you want to say. So I won't go too much into in depth, and I'm not a historian or anything, so I can only speak for my personal experience. But yeah, so Liberia did, it's a country that was, I guess, or is habitated by descendants of freed slaves from America, or free Black people from America. And yeah, that did cause some friction in the country and has been, I guess, the root of some of the issues in the country. And so you would call those descendants of freed slaves Americo-Liberians, and then indigenous Liberians for those who were there prior to them coming there. And I think, I guess, in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement and just me being a first gen, it's interesting because I always feel like I'm in this in-between phase. With those who do know about Liberia, oftentimes Africans, and I've gotten into different situations, they'll be like, oh, you're Liberian, you're not a real African. Because the thought is that all Liberians are from America or from elsewhere, and so we don't necessarily count. And then being Black in America and me, you know, being proud to be Liberian, I tell people often and they're like, okay, well, you're not really Black either. So you don't really fit in here. And so it's always been an in-between thing. Sometimes it takes a lot of education too, because, you know, having African parents, they're not who were immigrants here. They didn't grow up here either. They're not well versed in all of the structural norms and institutions in America that affect Black Americans. And so sometimes it's about me educating them as well as educating myself, because, you know, I grew up in America, but I felt that I grew up more Liberian than American in a sense. And then it's also weird because whenever I go to Liberia, they're like, you're not really Liberian because you were in a, you grew up in America. So it's just like, it's always this balance and this juggle of people saying, oh, you're not this, you're not that, or you don't have the right to say X, Y, Z. And, you know, constant education. And then even as I said, my father, he's Pele. My mother is more is Americo-Liberian. And so, and actually my father is half-half. So his family were descendants of those who came from South Carolina. And then my mom's family is actually descendants of people who came from Barbados. And if you go to Liberia, you'll find a lot of Bajans who are Liberians, or Liberians who came from Barbados, and same thing, Liberians who came from South Carolina or from somewhere down south. And so speaking of South Carolina, if you know, I know what's become more popular in the food industry when you look at pioneers like Chef BJ Dennis or Michael Twitty, they're really harping on, you know, Southern cuisine and how it has African roots, and especially in South Carolina with the Geechee Gullah people. When you look at, or when I look at some of their cuisines, I look at Liberian food and I'm like, this is the same thing that we eat. Like there's something called dry rice that we eat in Liberia that's like parboiled rice with smoked fish, maybe some fried okra, fried fish, and then we drizzle red oil over it. There's like a dish that Geechee Gullah people that looks just like that. Or even the okra that they make looks just like, I think they make gumbo that looks like our okra sauce in Liberia. And so when you see pictures like that, it's like, okay, you see how food has traveled across continents, across oceans, based on the slave trade and based on the movement of Black people across the world due to slavery. And so, I mean, it's interesting. I definitely do identify with the Black Lives Movement. I'm a Black woman in America at the end of the day, and I was born here in America. So the life I live in America, they don't care if you're Liberian or you're Nigerian.
No one is going to ask you to whip out your passport and be like, oh, hey, I'm actually from wherever.
And so, you know, those things affect me. And then it's interesting because being in school again, and then also I'm a part of this other organization called the Global Shapers under World Economic Forum. You see how some of these different institutions are structured in a way to not even give fair representation to Black people. And it's kind of frustrating sometimes. And it's a different fight that you have to take on. Like me talking to different faculty and administration at my school about different diversity and inclusion initiatives, talking about how to speak about these issues, how to have these conversations that everyone else is uncomfortable with having, but Black people have been uncomfortable for hundreds of years living in America. It's just, it's very frustrating. It's constant work and constant education. And then even sometimes I find myself having to re-educate myself because somebody can't be out there speaking more about these topics than I can be. So I don't know. It's weird. And at the end of the day, I mean, it is what it is. And it's something that needs to be acknowledged and it needs to be addressed. So, I mean, the history of Liberia does have some roots in America. There's counties in Liberia that are named Virginia and Maryland County, which come from America. But it's definitely a blend of cultures, because then you have a lot of people who immigrated to Liberia from Sierra Leone or from Guinea, especially because we share borders. and vice versa. And then you have a lot of Lebanese people there, a lot of Chinese people there because of, you know, this modern day colonization, if you want to call it that. And it's a small country, but it's a very interesting country, and it has a very interesting history because even having Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as president prior to George Weah, she had a lot of huge ties with the U.S. and received a lot of international acclaim. The president before that, Charles Taylor, he was well known in the international community for a lot of things he did. Then the president before that, which is when the coup happened, Tolbert, he was known by the international community as well and was like the last president who really had the country in a position to progress and to be on par with a lot of these other developing nations. So I don't know. I could talk about the history of Liberia and a lot of the dichotomies.
No, it's all so fascinating to me. I think Liberia is unique in that way. But thank you. You do think you had a lot to say, but you actually shared quite a bit that was helpful, I think. So thank you. So as we're wrapping up, want to find out what's next for you. You talked about the summer accelerator program that you were in. Like, what sort of is the outcome of that? And then what are you going to be doing next?
Yeah, so the outcome from that, I worked on Mishan Spices through the summer accelerator program. It's basically about teaching entrepreneurs how to scale businesses. And so I learned a lot about, you know, financial modeling, venture capital, pitching to investors, developing a go-to-market strategy, all sorts of things. And so I'm very grateful for that experience because I can take those learnings and, you know, grow this company so that it's able to live on even after I've graduated. And so in terms of what's next for me, I'm going to be focusing on Mishan Spices. I'll still be doing things with Tolbert Hospitality, but not as much given COVID and my comfortability level. Being at GW as an MBA student, I've been able to work on several different consulting projects that involve food in Africa. And so my goal has always been to, you know, work with different industries on the continent, especially that involve agriculture. So I worked on something in sustainable supply chains in Rwanda. I worked on a food exportation project with a confectionery company in South Africa. And so I would love to continue working on projects like that, that kind of blend my skills in management, hospitality and tourism and culinary. And then what I'm learning from my MBA program to kind of bring everything together. I definitely think I lead like this untraditional path, especially for somebody who's in an MBA program. And then just for someone in general, yeah. I tend to follow things that I like and enjoy, which is scary and it's a risk in itself, but I don't like wasting time on things if I don't like them. I think that is a waste of my time. So
yeah, I think that's a great philosophy to have. And if COVID has taught us anything, it's about, you know, no one knows what's going to come tomorrow. And so do the things that you want to do, focus on the things and the people that, you know, you care about and move forward. So that's fantastic. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about you before I interviewed you, and I've learned so much more. I'm inspired, actually. I'm like, dang, I need to like step up my game a little bit here. So before we transition to the rapid fire segment, can you let people know where they can find you, not just on your website? I think you mentioned the website, but social media handles, etc.
Yeah, social media handles are Tolbert Hospitality, so TLBRT Hospitality. That's on Instagram and Facebook. Mishan Spices, MESEAN Spices on Instagram and Facebook as well. If you want to connect with me, I'm on LinkedIn, Dominique Tolbert. You can find me there. And yeah, that's pretty much, I'm not hard to find. I reply to people. So
cool.
Yeah, you
all
can
right.
find me.
So let's do our rapid fire questions. So let's start. Coffee or tea?
Tea.
Dine in or take out?
Oh, that's a good question. I like dining in by myself, actually. I love to like sit at a bar and eat and drink basically from the whole menu. but other than that, takeout is cool.
Okay. This will be interesting. I wasn't going to ask this question, but because we talked about it earlier, I'm like, let me see what she says. Liberian or Senegalese jollof?
Liberian. That's not even a question.
Really? Interesting. Okay, I thought you'd go. Okay, I thought you'd go for Senegalese, but okay.
It's a very close second.
Morning person or night person?
Night. I hate waking up in the morning. I'm not a morning person at all.
Savory or sweet?
Savory.
And then finally, your favorite African restaurant anywhere in the world?
I love like eating at somebody's mom's house in their kitchen.
Oh, okay.
So that's my favorite.
That's probably the best.
Yeah, I think that's the that's the best way to go.
Yeah, that is the actually that's the best answer I've heard. Cool. All right, so we've come to the end of our conversation. This is great. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. I learned so much more than I expected to, and I hope that people listening did as well. Thank you for listening to Item 13, an African food podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. To keep up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Item 13 Podcast. Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.